All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
All right, and we are back for another episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. An historic week in the world of English football as England reached their first final since 1966 and their first ever in the European Championships. We review their game against Denmark and look ahead to the final against Italy on Sunday. And we will also be giving a preview on the Poirier versus McGregor fight in Vegas this weekend. What are you more looking forward to? And I'm going to put you on the spot here. You're more looking forward to the England European Championship final against Italy. You're looking forward to that fight in Vegas.
I've got to say, I'm looking forward to the final a bit more because this is never, in my lifetime and in several lifetimes previous, this hasn't happened. This hasn't happened since my dad was about five. So you have to give respect to the occasion. Even though I am looking forward to the fight between McGregor and Poirier, and we're going to go through that a bit later, but you can't put anything above the final, can you, really?
No, it's still hard to believe. I think a lot of England fans are still pinching themselves. I don't think in our wildest dreams we thought we were going to be in this position with England, but obviously, some people did. Joe Barr had a big bet on him, didn't he? I think he's had the double. He's had the European Championship winners and the World Cup winners double.
But he says it every time, so it's hard to take him seriously.
Yeah, every England fan thinks we're going to win it at the start of every tournament. So it's just so happened that we are in the final and we've got a good chance of doing that.
Well, it's just been a bit different this time, hasn't it? This is a very different England team than what we're used to seeing. But we're going to go through it in a little bit.
Yeah, so we're going to crack on with the five things you might have missed. Sha'Carri Richardson, the American sprinter who tested positive for marijuana, is set to miss out on the Tokyo Olympics after not being selected for the 4x100 relay team. What did you make of this, Jim?
The girl's 21 years old. She won the Olympic trials in June with the sixth fastest time in history, and she should be going to the Games. Look, I love the devil's cabbage myself, so I'm admittedly biased, but I can't see why it's on the banned list other than to accentuate the Olympic lie of clean living and fair competition. And it's tempting to point to her age and assume she's got several Olympic cycles left. But you never know what's around the corner. She could get injured, she could start a family, all those kind of things. I think it's a shame she's not going. And it's the innate hypocrisy of big corporations, organisations, governing bodies like the IOC, like FIFA. They seem like arbitrary rules that they put on people and they cost people their wildest dreams. She's probably been training since she was about 8 years old for this. And I think it's a bit ridiculous.
Ridiculous is the one, it is the perfect word for it because I think it's 40% now of the states in America have legalized marijuana.
Is that 40 states or 40%?
40%. I think it's about 18 or 19 of the 51 states.
Well, you know, India brought this up to me the other day and she said that the IOC should take into account where the games are being held. But because this is in Japan as well, like, weeds are super no-no over there.
Yeah.
But also, the IOC make their own regulations. The law of the land doesn't apply as much as you think it would. They make government sign contracts and stuff, and they bring their own rules to the table. So it's the IOC's fault, and it's a shame. I hope she gets into another Olympic Games, but for the time being, it's just a waste, isn't it?
I mean, she looks electric. She looks a great personality as well. If you haven't seen, I think it was in one of the semi-finals of the Olympic trials the other day when she, I think she hit a score, a time of 10.64 or something around there. In the last sort of 30 metres, as she absolutely blitzed all opponents, she was pointing at the clock as she was for the last 30 yards. If you haven't seen that, it's absolutely brilliant. And, you know, she just looks like what a great personality for the sport. Like, she's got this like blue shock of hair, then she's got like the orange dyed hair.
Yeah, she's someone you
long
can,
thing now. Yeah. She looks wicked, man.
She's someone you can pick out of a crowd, and that's good for advertising and good for the sport and good for just getting people involved and getting excited about things. And she's fast, do you know what I mean? Which is the most important thing, but she's missing out this year.
Yeah, let's just hope that the Olympic committees can come to their senses and make sure that she's on our screens in the future. All right, so number two. And you're going to enjoy this one, aren't you? Joey Chestnut has set a new world record managing to eat 76 hot dogs in 10 minutes. That is a combined calorie intake of 22,800 and 1,824 grams of carbohydrates. So Chestnut is one of the most prolific athletes in the world of competitive eating and has now won the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest 14 of the last 15 years. The guy's a superstar and even has his own brand of grilling and wing sauces. And he apparently made his breakthrough into the competitive eating scene with a good performance in a deep-fried asparagus eating championship.
Classic, yeah.
And he's now that prestigious tournament. And he's now so good at eating hot dogs, he's breaking his own world records.
Well, the only man to halt Chestnut's relentless march to hot dog glory in that period is a guy called Matt Stoney, whose YouTube channel I've been a fan of for years. That what these competitors do takes preparation, tactics, and extreme physical capacity. It's a sport in every sense. I know it seems ridiculous, but I can't help but be impressed when you see people inhaling large amounts of food and set to a timer. It's a novelty sport, but it's a sport nonetheless.
Yeah, and I suppose you would need to pace yourself, wouldn't you? A bit like a long distance runner would, because you can't just like go and eat, say, 20 in 2 minutes and then try and finish the other sort of 50 in the like 8 minutes. Yeah, I'm sure there needs to be, as you say, like some sort of tactical element to it.
That Matt Stoney guy, he has loads of cups of water ready, and they eat the hot dog bun as well, I think.
Yeah.
So they crunch up the bun, drink that with the water, make that dissolve with the water, then kind of swallow the hot dog.
And so they don't have to, there's no rules that have to, the dog doesn't need to be in the bread.
No, you just have to eat it.
So as long as you consume it
and
you can use as much liquid as you want, and it doesn't matter which liquid you use.
And he went through his tactic before. He said once he gets to a certain point, his esophagus gets kind of like roadblocked. So you see him wriggling and shaking from side to side to make the food go down. It seems dangerous to me, to be honest, but, you know.
That is mental. We should have a go one day on the podcast.
yeah, that would be a great soundbite.
number three. Jim, have you got any old cricket pads in the garage and a bat that you might, you might get a call up to the England cricket team this month, because they're facing Pakistan in their T20 games and the One Day Internationals, and the whole current team for the ODIs have been forced into isolation due to a coronavirus breach in which at least three players and four members of the backroom staff contracted the virus. And unlike England's decision to withdraw from the ODI series against South Africa in December, Pakistan have agreed to go ahead, and England will be fielding a completely new squad, which will field a host of debutants. I think that's been announced in the last few days, with a 2020 squad still to be announced. I think that those start on the 17th, I think, against Pakistan. Imagine if the England team, for example, 3 days before the Euros, or not even 3 days, maybe a week before the Euros, they had a coronavirus breach, four of the players tested positive, everyone had to self-isolate, and England had to pick a completely new squad. We'd still be in the final, probably, actually, because England's depth is pretty good in that regard.
Yeah, we'd be all right, to be fair. Surely the sensible option there is to just withdraw.
Well, I think they probably wanted to, but I think it has to be agreed by both parties. And Pakistan were like, nah, we're all right.
No, we're good. yeah. Oh, fair play. Yeah. All's fair in love and war.
We'll still play. So I wouldn't be having a bet on England and the new boys, but you never know. And number four, baseball fan makes a catch of the century at an Arizona Diamondbacks game. He risked dropping two of life's most precious resources in order to pluck the ball out of the air. His overpriced domestic beer and his real-life human child. So fortunately for both of them, Super Dad had a killer catch and managed to snag the ball out of the air whilst holding onto both the child and aforementioned overpriced beer. It was a tense moment in sporting history and certainly worth checking out on the interwebs.
You know, India sent me the clip before you ever mentioned it to me, and the faces of everyone around him, they go from shock to relief to appreciation. He should be on the field, not in the stands.
He
didn't even seem embarrassed by what he did. He was just like, yeah!
yeah. All right, and lastly, have you heard the Atomic Kitten Southgate song?
Yeah, the worst atomic phenomena since Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We'll just leave it there.
Well, it's, at least we give that reference time to boil over, unlike that Brazilian reporter in 1950, where he was calling it Hiroshima, only a few years after like the worst event in human history.
You know, my least favorite thing about this song is that they say Gareth Southgate turns them on. They're like middle aged women by now. Southgate's hardly a hunk. It brings all sorts of uncomfortable imagery into my head, and also it's a blatant cash grab. Fair play to them. They've not been in the charts for a long time.
They haven't been relevant, but you know, obviously, if England win this final, then potentially they could be on for a pretty big windfall. You never know, man.
That's true.
But are you going to give us a rendition of it?
I'm all right, you know. Thanks. I'm just going to bypass that one. I'm good.
Do you want a rendition of it?
No, I'm all right. Thanks.
Alright, so that's the five things you might have missed this week. We're going to crack on straight into the football chat. Obviously, this is going to be all England-based, as it has been for the last few weeks in the Euros. We're going to have a short review of England versus Ukraine, so you take us away with that.
Yeah, so this was the real Remembrance Day, and it was inevitable. The game coincided with Big Joe's 30th birthday party. Thanks again, son, it was a good one. And our recollections of it were bound to be fuzzy. The opening goal aside, the highlights next morning, as I waited for my hangover Papa John's, were a completely new experience for me. I remembered the score and the scorers, but not much else. Kane scored two and could have had a third with a left-footed volley from outside the box. This coming after weeks of us slating him on the podcast. Fair play, son. Sterling Dinho was splitting Ukraine's defences with flicks, tricks and penetrating passes. Slabhead Harry Maguire smashed it again and grabbed the goal. Old man Henderson broke his England duck. Shaw and Walker had the whole place on lockdown. Pickford looked like the second coming of Gordon Banks. What more do you want from an England performance?
I don't actually remember any of the game. I mean, I only watched the first half and then I had to dip. Obviously, I had to go to a wedding. So I only really saw the result probably 2 or 3 hours after like the game had finished. So
you're a man of principles and you snuck out of that party quietly, which you would have had to do because we'd have been dragging you by your socks back into the...
Mouse-like. Yeah, had to sneak out. But even the first half, like, I remember the goal. Just brilliant play from Sterling. Yet again, like everything that England have created so far in this tournament seems to have ran through Sterling. I think every goal he's had some kind of part in. Yeah. Obviously, even, you know, we're going to talk about the Denmark game, but... You know, apart from the sort of set pieces from Shaw, where obviously Henderson scored and Maguire scored, but every other open play goal, I think Sterling has had a really large part of. Yeah. So
him and Shaw have linked up like impeccably, really. And because the threat's so real from both of them, whether Sterling's going to dribble and he can cross the ball himself, or then Shaw's on the overlap, or Shaw can come short and then cross from that kind of deeper position on the left-hand side, really dangerous working in tandem.
Like Sterling sometimes will pull out wide. And Shaw invert slightly and he'll move into that sort of half space on that side of the field. So it just creates that sort of depth and that angle between them. And because they're so rapid, both of them, so quick.
And it creates that uncertainty for the defence. They don't know when to commit a defender to the, or when to go, or when to follow players, or when one of them cuts inside, which happens sometimes as well. It's presenting a lot of attacking options, man. And that's been our best kind of... best bit of chemistry within the team, I'd say.
Yeah, I mean, the only thing that I would use as a criticism for England is, you know, are we turning into a bit of a one-trick pony in terms of, like, where our goals are coming from? Like, we're strong from set pieces. We can see that because, obviously, we do look a threat from set pieces. And it seems to be those sort of wide areas that we're getting the most joy from, don't we? Yeah. We don't really seem to be penetrating much in the middle. It seems to be those half spaces either side of those wide flanks and middle area.
I don't think teams in general do that. I remember seeing De Bruyne split the... I can't remember who they were playing, but for Lukaku. I remember they scored like a nice little FIFA goal there. But in terms of threading through the needle, you don't really see teams doing that, I don't think.
Yeah.
And a lot of the goals tend to come in from the wider areas, even if it's cutting inside with the runs or if it's just crosses. Like, England probably crossed the ball a lot more than most teams, but I don't think that's a negative. You've got to play to your strengths, haven't you, really?
Yeah, and I think it'll be interesting to see how Italy approached their sort of defensive setup. We will go through that a little bit more in about 10 or 15 minutes, but... We'll review the England versus Denmark game, which was on Wednesday. So that's the most fresh in our memory.
Obviously, we actually both remember it as well.
Which is good. I mean, both of those sort of... both the England games in the last few weeks have been a bit of a contrast, really, in terms of, like, Ukraine was a team that we expected to beat. Denmark were a team that we probably did expect to beat, but it was a completely different sort of tactical challenge, don't you think?
It's been the toughest game so far. I mean, what the Danes presented in terms of their ball retention, their transitions between defending and attacking, and just sheer unpredictability and composure, they were the best team we've played so far. I know they got off to a late start in the tournament after what happened with Eriksen, and then they got through on the basis of a 4-goal win against Russia. Probably really lucky to graduate from the group stages, but after 40 minutes, I was thinking, these could go on and win the tournament, never mind, like us beating them. They were looking ridiculous, man. Absolutely ridiculous. But it kind of... they petered out after a little bit. It was kind of like how they played Belgium when they put pedal to the metal for 40 minutes and they looked like unbelievable.
And you said that, didn't you?
Yeah.
You said that you think Denmark will tire and Belgium will come back and win 2-1. Obviously, at that point, Belgium had the luxury of bringing on Hazard and Kevin De Bruyne at half time.
I didn't have that same confidence for England. It's difficult to be objective about England. Where it's easy to look at Belgium with the players they've got and the players they could bring on and say, they're going to turn this around. But when you're in a semi-final, a rare semi-final with England, it's really tough to disassociate yourself.
I mean, we'll talk about how each of the teams set up tactically. I mean, Denmark were in a sort of a 3-4-3, and they kept that system both in possession and out possession, I thought. And they were kind of like a mid block, so blocking around the halfway line, so the front forwards around the halfway line. Danish press on backwards passes, which is a big sort of thing. Like nowadays, if that pass goes backwards, you're meant to crunch up, press the ball, and just congest that field. So basically, just move up as a unit. England was sort of a 4-4-2. Out of possession sometimes, caught a high block, not a high press. But I think as the game wore on, they started to press a lot more. But I think England actually did give Denmark a lot of respect when they were in possession. And they didn't try and just sort of press them relentlessly. They did just sit off and try and block passes into the sort of danger areas. And then obviously when we're in possession, that's when we sort of developed that sort of 4-3-3, which we've become accustomed to, except from the Germany game. So did you see the Danish standing on the line from the corners? Did you notice that? So I haven't seen that from any team in the Euros, and I haven't really seen it. It's kind of like an old school tactic.
I didn't notice that at all, but I did notice they were doing some like NFL type stuff from free kicks where the Danish players would hunker really close around the England defensive players. And then when the free kick was coming in, they'd break and blitz and spread out. And I was thinking, how do you deal with that if you're England?
And that's how they won the free kick that Damsgaard scored, that magnificent.
Because Luke Shaw dragged your boy back, didn't he?
Christensen. I think it might have been. But I thought that was really clever, man. I'm not sure, off the top of my head, I can't think of what their coach is called, but I would be keeping an eye on him in terms of like, you know, him getting a job in the sort of the big leagues in a few years or whatever.
I like seeing things like that. And because the game, in the last couple of years, especially in the Premier League, the game has changed quite a lot, hasn't it? A lot of possession, a lot of goalkeepers being given a lot more possession responsibility. And, you know, just general quicker passing. It's kind of like an evolution of the tiki-taka football that was going on in Spain like 10 years ago, that kind of vibe. And to see people innovating in these really niche areas, like set pieces, that brings me like a little bit of joy. It's like, oh, someone's doing something different. They're not just playing by the rule book. They're trying to extend things.
Innovate.
And push them.
Yeah, definitely. The guy's name's Kasper Schulman, so I think it would have been a bit of...
He's Danish.
A bit disrespectful, really, to not know too much about him. So he looks like he's coached in Denmark his whole life. He was at Mainz in Germany for a year. But then he went to Nordjylland, is that right, for 3 years. And then he took over the Danish team. So no real playing career. Looks like he played in college football in America. 49 years old. Looks good for his age.
Yeah, man, you don't have to have good playing experience to be a good coach. Oftentimes, I think not having good player experience actually aids you as a coach. Because I feel like that insecurity bubbles into an efficacy, a professionalism. Like Jose Mourinho, he didn't play nothing, did he? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, Arsene Wenger.
He was like a fringe team in a fringe player in a bad team in a terrible league. So that just shows you the extent.
Yeah, a lot of the top coaches aren't ex-players. Obviously, you know, with the exception of Southgate, if we're going to talk about him. There is coaches out there that played, but Southgate's of a different mould, I think. He's not a traditional... English. I think he's quite innovative, like Southgate. He's not in the same mould as like Tony Adams and Roy Keane and Graham Souness. I know they're a little bit older. Obviously, Souness is a little bit older, but Roy Keane's around the same age. And I feel like they have a very traditional... I don't want to criticise them, but it's kind of like stuck in those sort of like 90s, 2000 era.
Well, I'll say something to you, and this is not a criticism of you. I just think it's an example of how all of our perceptions have changed of Gareth Southgate over the course of this tournament. I remember when the Euros first started and both of us were doubting, does he have the tactical nous? Does he have the balls to experiment? When it comes to the crunch, is he just going to stick with the same old tactics or is he going to try something new? Is he going to push the envelope? I didn't think he'd be able to do the things he's done.
I would argue he still hasn't seen a crunch moment. Obviously, Denmark went 1-0 up. But we got back into it within 9 minutes. I think that says a lot about the, you know, we spoke about England dealing with adversity and we haven't seen them have to deal with adversity. And they proved that in that 10 minutes after the goal.
I wouldn't want them to go into the final having not experienced that moment.
Yeah, true.
Because if we obviously it's a really advantageous thing to have such an efficient defence that you don't concede goals. But what happens if Italy go 1-0 up in 10 minutes? Do you know what I mean? You need to know how to experience that, to overcome it, and that'll be a massive boost to all the players. And it was an unbelievable free kick that Damsgaard scored.
Really was.
That would be, if anything's going to get your head down, it'd be something like that. So the way they bounced back, I thought was, I think we're jumping ahead on your tactical breakdown here. Sorry.
No, I mean, we're kind of in that same view. I mean, I've wrote down there, like Denmark, I think they settled massively after 20 minutes. They grew into the game after that sort of early barrage from England where they started like really sharp and looked like they were on the front foot, didn't they? And we thought, right, If we can keep this intensity up, this is going to be it's going to be a strong performance for England.
I thought the first 20 were quite even, you know. I thought England were not conservative, but they definitely weren't reckless in terms of, you know, like closing every little thing down. They go right up to the wire, then they're happy to come back, regain their shape. England's organisation throughout this tournament has been something that's impressed me endlessly. Every game, I see something new, and I see something like players directing each other, bollocking each other, pointing over there, cover there. You know what I mean? There's communication that I haven't seen from players in the past.
I do think the shape has suited England massively. Just like that 4-3-3 system with the wide players, you know, they can invert the wing backs pushing up, like Luke Shaw with his pace, Kyle Walker with his pace, and you know. Once again, we spoke about Kyle Walker's pace getting us out of trouble, and it did again. I think it was in the first half. A beautiful passage of play, about 4 or 5 passes, one touch passing from Denmark.
Yeah, and it went over the top.
And it went over the top. And luckily, Kyle Walker's pace, he got round and managed. But
it wasn't just.
At that point, I was like, these fucking boys can play, man. Like, what the fuck?
And you know what? Once it's not just his. I think we're doing Walker and Shaw a discredit. By saying it's just their pace, it's not just their pace.
No,
it's their positional awareness, their anticipation, and their organisation between each other. I feel like I'm talking about like a proper tournament-winning team when I'm saying these things, but it's what England are doing. I am not this die-hard face-painted guy. I'm really not. I'm telling you what I'm seeing, and England have been pretty solid so far.
Obviously, Luke Shaw looking like a world-class left back. Harry Kane looking sharp. Ever since we've criticised him, Sterling once again isolating players one on one. Is he the best player in world football at doing that? Isolating players one-on-one. And if you're a defender, any defender, even the Italians, would you want to be one-on-one with spacing behind you?
Because he's so unpredictable. Sometimes I feel like he doesn't even have a plan. He's kind of just feeling where he's going. This intuitive approach to dribbling, which is kind of what you need. Because if you don't know what you're doing, the guy's not going to anticipate what you're doing.
Exactly.
And that might be an oversimplification. But when there's yards behind him, and Sterling's one-on-one with the defender, you fancy him every time. Now, he might not get through every time. The Danes defended really well. And more than once, he got the ball plucked from his toe. But he was never discouraged. He was happy to do that again. Wait for the overlap from Shaw. Or wait for another, like Rice, to collect the ball from... He's even happy to come back, bring it back to midfield, bring it back to the keeper, play out again. They're not bothered, are they? They're not shook at all.
Which is, I think that's something, one of the philosophies within the England setup that they've been trying to embed for quite a few years, ever since the U17 and I think it was the U20 teams, they won their respective trophies. I think it was the U17s that won the World Cup and U20s won the European Championships. I can't remember exactly what trophies it was, but Phil Foden and Jadon Sancho, at least in this group, were part of that England setup. So there's a definite embedded philosophy and transition from those sort of youth levels into the England team, and they've been using the same tactics, delivering the same kind of team talks and the same kind of strategical sort of information. So.
Which is a bit mad because, like, didn't Gareth Southgate flop it with the under 21s and that? Like, didn't he?
Yeah,
it's a bit. We were talking,
and about obviously Adi Boothroyd, with more recently with the under 21s. Failed to get out of the group stages. So
it's a bit weird, that whole thing is, man. But it seems to have just come to a climactic point at the perfect time for England in this tournament.
But the thing is, and I think we might have spoke about this last week, the Germans have had a footballing philosophy for decades. Like, the Spanish have had a clear embedded football philosophy for decades. And the fact is, and so, same as the Italians, they do defensive work the best. They take pride in defensive work. We really haven't had that, but now we're starting to develop it, man. And I think it's this sort of like no fear approach of like, you know, look, try something out. If you fail, try again. You know what I mean? Fail as many times as you want, but we'll get it right eventually.
Failure is not a reason not to try and attempt things, because you have to be adventurous, you have to be daring. You can't win a tournament being conservative. It's just not going to happen, is it?
Yeah, so second half, I don't think England started as well second half. I think Denmark looked a little bit more comfortable in possession. And the game really slowed down a bit. That sort of high intensity, that high tempo that we had at the start. So we sort of dropped off a little bit. But Kane looking like the player we've seen at Tottenham. He really is. Ever since the moment we have slagged him off on this podcast, he's been absolutely brilliant.
Well, we've done him and the nation a favour then, haven't we? Because, no, he looks like a new man. But his performance against Germany was one of the single worst performances I've ever seen from an England player. I don't care if he scored the goal. Honestly, he was shocking the whole time. Against Ukraine, the opportunity that he missed with that left-footed volley, you're like, Jesus, like, that's the guy.
There he is.
That's the guy.
Yeah.
And he walked down to the pitch as that guy against Denmark, and he's formidable, holding up the ball, bringing other players in, threatening with his runs. He's not the paciest. He's not this graceful guy, but he's willing to run. He's willing to drag players out, and he's always, always a threat in the box. And with those wide attacking chances from Shaw, Sterling. And in this game, I thought it was a little bit ironic because pre-match, the pundits were talking about everything comes down the left side for England, as you kind of alluded to earlier. But Saka, a lot was going through Saka in this game. And I think it was the first goal. That it was the same kind of move, wasn't it? Out to Saka, ping it across. It was a great save from Kasper Schmeichel the first time round from Sterling. And then the second one was an own goal from Shaw, wasn't it?
So, yeah.
And it was that movement again. Saka was a little bit, I wouldn't say disappointing. I think he was a bit overmatched by the defender.
I thought there was a little bit of a physical battle there with him because obviously he's quite a small Saka, but
he's up for it, wasn't he?
He's a bit like Sterling. His physicality, I was really impressed with. He managed to stay on his feet. He didn't really get bullied by any defenders. I was impressed with him yet again. Obviously that first goal, I think the ball started with Kyle Walker. It must have been on that right hand side. What he's doing differently now is he seemed to be a lot more attuned with the players. Like he the timing of his runs timing of him pulling out from being on the last defender on the centre back, either one of three probably would have been Vestergaard or Christensen. So he's pulled off him, and then the pass came in at the right time this time, and he had time to turn on the half turn on his left foot, and then play that pass in between that gap. So because Vestergaard or whoever it was, the centre-back, didn't go with him and put pressure on him and not allow him to turn. No centre midfielder went with him. So either Thomas Delaney or Højbjerg didn't go with him. They were a bit too delayed to get there. He had time to open up and play that beautiful pass into Saka.
He was up to speed, wasn't he, man?
Yeah.
He was up to speed.
Bonucci and Killy weren't allowed him to do that.
let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's bathe in the glory of semi-final victory before we look towards...
And Jorginho will probably be literally so close he'd be able to smell his sweat.
Stop missing, my erection's faltering.
So, I mean, generally, I think the second half, obviously, England pressed a little bit higher, prevented Denmark from building. It started to, we started to turn the screw at the sort of like end of that first period of 90. I thought Poulsen was a bad sub for Denmark. I think Dahlberg was having a great game. He got brought after 6-7 minutes.
Tell you what, the coach did us a few favours with his substitution choices, to be honest with you.
And once again, their passes into those spaces between full-back and centre-backs, they're going to be the key to England's success and gambling on the pace of the wide players. But if we know that, then Mancini and his backroom staff know that. So I honestly think they'll set up in a similar way to they did against Spain. Obviously, we're not as sort of proficient as a possession side as Spain, but we can be pretty incisive if you want to. You know what I mean? We can play quickly through the thirds.
I think both of us now itching to get into this preview for the final. Let's just talk about the penalty quickly, because you can't brush over this, because it's a massive... It's the reason we went through. And if I was a Danish fan, if I was a Denmark player, I would be absolutely fuming. There's no way that was a penalty. No one could convince me that was a penalty.
Allow me. the only case you can make for it is there was two instances of contact. And at the speed at which Raheem Sterling runs and how he drives at defenders. And I'm not saying he took a... I think that he went down softly. So, 99% of the people on the planet are going to say that, that aren't England fans, are going to say that it was a dive. But he did have contact on his right knee, I think, from Joachim Mailer initially. And then I think it was Christensen that came in with his sort of hip. and had contact with him on that side. The argument is...
Your argument is...
if you're running at speed... All right, they should just try recreate it. Like,
I would say 2 points of contact, one from a strong gust of wind and another from a sniper's bullet in the stand.
And also, who cares?
This is what This is what I'm getting to. Let's get rid of the pretense of fair play. I don't care that he dived. I think he dived. I think that was a nailed on dive. It shouldn't have been a penalty. But there were other instances in the game. One with Kane right at the edge of the box when that was a nailed on penalty and they didn't give it. And there was another one earlier on that I can't quite...
He did win the ball, but he went through the player as well. So
this comes back to the wider conversation of inconsistency when it comes to the officiating. It is what it is. And I don't care. I do not care. England are in the final by hook or by crook. Give me all the crooks you can. I'm not bothered, man.
We are due our luck as well. We are due it. After all those, you know, this even the Beckham in 1998, where he had that little flick, and Simeone went. Was it
Simeone did
went
17
down.
Gambles and got him a red card.
You know, obviously the ghost goal in 2010
Lampard
with Lamps.
Against Germany. Yeah.
The Welsh got Ronaldo giving old Beckham
getting
the wink. Rooney sent off with the old wink. What more do you want?
This is all part of the game, and it's a convenient position to take for us. I don't care. We're in.
Yeah, no, we're there. We're there.
And you know, Harry Kane, he weren't the best penalty in the world, but I think he did really well on the rebound. I got to say, man.
I tell you what, let's just say fair play to Denmark. What a great team performance that was generally. Kasper Schmeichel was brilliant. They defended absolutely heroically.
Yeah.
And like, and we spoke off air. Like we said, if that would have been against any other team, we would have been gutted for Denmark because like...
I am gutted for Denmark.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
They were fantastic.
What happened with Eriksen and then their surprise graduation from the group stages and then the way they turned it up in the knockout stages. They're a good team and they showed moment. They showed 40 minutes of being absolutely incredible. We were talking in the group chat. They're like, Jesus Christ, like, where did these lads come from? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it was
and
so
that's
impressive.
A testament to England's composure. They were able to overcome a proper team, you know, so... Fair play to Denmark. I'm sorry that they had to get done over by a dodgy call, but ultimately, I don't care. England are in the final. Sweet.
Right, let's go through the player ratings real quick. So we'll just kind of deliberate on all these. I mean, Pickford, it was his probably worst game in the tournament.
Very dodgy, but...
He's going to win the Golden Glove, though, isn't he?
But you know when the long shots come in and these situations where past England keepers have been pretty dodgy... He still seems quite solid to me. I know he made a few dodgy passes and he tries to play it a bit quick when maybe he should hold it down. He did put England in jeopardy on several occasions, but he's still bollocks the defenders. He still tries to organise everyone. He's still a personality. He's still a force in that back four or five, however it's going on. So a six, I'd say.
I think I agree with you. Yeah, I think I'll go with a six as well. Kyle Walker.
I'm going to say eight, but only because I've got a nine coming up.
Okay, all right. So yeah. I'm going to say a seven. I think there was areas of his game, once again, that could have been a little bit better in terms of, obviously, he had that pass through to Kane. I'm sure it was him. Must have been on that right side. His pace, once again, always gets out of trouble. But also his positioning, as you said, in his reading of the game, his anticipation. Should we give him a 7.5 then? If you're going to give him an 8.
If we're going to compromise, I'm happy with a 7.5.
All right, so, and what about Juan Stones?
I think he might have been overshadowed by his centre-back partner. If I remember correctly, he did make a few ropey passes where the Danes were closing down, which, again, if Pickford's in dodgy form, you're inviting trouble there. But these things can happen in a football game.
And if you're going to give Slabhead an 8, we've got to give him a 7, really, haven't we?
I'm not giving Slabhead an 8.
You're going for more than that?
I'm going for a 9.9, mate. He was unbelievable. He was unbelievable. I've never seen a player. He's here, there and everywhere. You know what I mean? Every time the ball came into the box, he was there.
Yeah, he's finally looking like an £80 million defender, isn't he?
That's the first thing I said. I was like, shit, it's a bargain. £200 million, at least.
Yeah,
he had an unbelievable game, and I don't think you can underestimate or undermine anything he did just because of past reputations. I'm not saying he's like the best ever centre-back. I'm saying in this game, he was unbelievable.
All right, Luke Shaw.
Same as Walker, 7.58, man.
Okay, 8, we'll give him an 8. I think, yeah, once again, like, just causing a threat down that left-hand side.
Yeah, that
with
link
Sterling.
Up with Sterling ridiculous, man, so, yeah.
And a lot of our goals have come from those areas, haven't they, really, just with their combination play. But once again, is that going to be a little bit too predictable for Italy? We'll see. Phillips and Rice, obviously, once again, they're in a game where they haven't really, I say they haven't had much to do, but what they do kind of goes under the radar a little bit.
You know what I liked about Phillips in this game? He was the one player from the middle who was trying adventurous passes. Now, probably 7 out of 10 times, they've got cut out or they didn't amount to anything. But I like the fact that he seems to have that vision where if England get into this pedestrian mode of lateral pass, backward pass, lateral pass, lateral pass, that can go into a bit of a funk into the game. Mm-hmm. There were several times against Denmark where he looked to create something with the wide areas. He looked to exploit that with his passing.
So. All right, so we'll give him a slightly better markup than Rice. Maybe we'll go for a 7 with Rice and a 7.5 Phillips just because he's trying to be a bit more positive on the front foot. Rice, again, the thing is about his position is he will do a lot of the dirty work. You know what I mean? So he'll do the stuff that we don't really necessarily see. We'd probably have to watch over the film again to see what he was doing in those certain situations. When you're watching a game and you're watching it sort of holistically, you don't really notice it. But if you focused on him all game, you'd probably give him an 8 or a 9 every
time. Yeah, you don't even want to watch a game like that, do you, really?
No, you can't. Sterling, I think for me, he's got to be at least an 8 again.
I'd say so.
Running through him, I'd say all of our dangerous attacks seem to run through him. Obviously, he put the pressure on the player for the own goal. He would have got there had it not been for the player getting there first and scoring their own goal. Obviously, won the penalty, whether you think it's a dubious decision or not. So, I mean, probably an 8.5, actually. Probably bump him up a little bit more. Saka, you said you weren't too impressed with him. I was fairly impressed.
It wasn't that I was unimpressed. It was that despite his unwillingness to get physically dominated, which I completely agree with you on that, it's just that there seemed to be a little bit of... He just seemed to be overthinking a little bit.
Okay.
And, you know, that's not like a massive criticism. It's a big game. He's a young lad. That can happen. And also, the Danish were really well organised defensively. There were times where around Sterling and around Saka, there's just 4 red shirts. Mm-hmm. And what are you supposed to do there? So they did a good job of penning him in. That's not a criticism against him, but despite the fact that he set up the first goal and could have had another one just before that, I think he was in and out of the game, more out of the game than in. So I'd drop him down from previous performances.
Okay, so maybe a 7.
Yep. 7's fair.
No, I don't think really you can give any of these players less than what we give. You know, Pickford's probably the bottom of it with a 6, but
I think Mount should get a 6 as well.
So what didn't you like about Mount?
I think he was very lucky to be on the pitch after he forearmed that Danish kid in the face. And I think after that, he was... the game seemed... In moments of possession and momentum, whenever the ball went to him, everything seemed to slow down. He seemed to be making inefficient decisions, I feel like he was making. So just on that basis, and the fact that he really shouldn't have been on the pitch.
Yeah, I mean, I think with Mount, obviously he gets... loads of plaudits, man. Like loads of people really, really enjoy what he does. I do see some good things from him, but nothing to the same level of consistency as what we've seen from Luke Shaw, from Sterling, in the last couple of games, from Kane, Maguire. For me, I don't really remember much about the game from Mount. I don't really remember him being involved in many sort of good possession plays. I'd probably be wrong if I watched it back, to be honest.
Once again, you
can't focus on every player.
This is all subject to review. Do you know what I mean? We're not saying, this is exactly how you should assess players. This is just our idea, our perception of the game. But my overall impression of Mount was, once we got to the hour mark in the game, I was just thinking, get him off. Just get him off now, because it's a bit too harsh to say he's an accident waiting to happen, but he's not aiding the team as much as other players perhaps would, i.e. Jack Grealish.
And it was unfortunately Saka that came off for Grealish again, so he seems to be that sort of 70-minute mark sub, and that'll be one of the criticisms I got from Southgate in a bit. So Mount will give us 6.5. Yeah.
If you want to give him the extra 0.5, then yeah.
And then Mr. Harry Kane.
Harry Kane.
He's not Fat Harry anymore.
And he's still fat. He's just not moving like a fat man. And that speaks to the shift in his perception, his confidence.
So is he the talisman now? Can he?
He's still not the talisman.
No, he's not. No, still not the talisman. But I think we've got to give him an 8.5. I'd say on the same as Sterling, if not a 9.
Really? You know, I was really surprised when he got man of the match, you know?
Yeah, a little bit. But I think it's probably because he scored the goal. But at the end of the day, he nearly missed the penalty. That if Schmeichel, I think actually it was a good job it wasn't as good as a penalty because Schmeichel actually overshot it a little bit. If that would have been more in the corner, I think Schmeichel would have gobbled that up, and it would have been like then. That's when you would have saw adversity. Yeah. But yeah, unluckily for Schmeichel, it bounced right back into his path.
And fair play to Kane on the rebound. He gave him the eyes, didn't he? He was looking one way and put it the other side. And Kasper still nearly got to it. Do you know what I mean? So I think I know he scored the goal, the winning goal, and you can't overlook that.
And he was part of that. He was a big part of that. The first goal as well.
Yeah, exactly.
With his movement.
But I honestly don't think you can put him ahead of Harry Maguire.
So we'll ask him an 8 then.
If he's got an 8.5 and if Sterling's got an 8.5, I think you've just got to drop him just below there, man.
All right, and let's have a quick word about Grealish, because obviously any Villa fans that are listening are definitely going to hear about this. There was a caller that came on TalkSport that said when Grealish was taken off after he'd come on in the 70th minute, he didn't care whether England won or lost.
That's just someone who loves Villa more than England, and that's, you know, fair enough, but... I don't think that's the majority.
Yeah,
I don't
even
think that's nearly the majority. I think that's a very very bitter reaction to what happened. But let me get your input on it. Tactically, what was happening in that game, do you think, that made Southgate jump into that kind of decision? Because it was unexpected.
I think the main thing is that now managers have the luxury of making 6 subs. So obviously you got the 5 subs in normal time and then think you get 1 more, if not 2 more. I think it might be 1 more in extra time. So the fact that you have that luxury, Jack Grealish is a player that really plays on the edge and he commits players. So Southgate thinks the game's won, potentially. Right, you know, there's 15 minutes left, but the way England were playing and the sort of tiredness that was in the Danish legs, it was a good indicator that the game was, you know, edging towards us. And he can bring on fresh legs from Trippier, a more defensive player. So,
and another threat from set pieces.
Another threat from set pieces, exactly. So there's a lot of reasons why. People were asking, why not take Kane off? Why not take Stone off? Did you see Sterling in the 120th minute, last minute of the game, still motoring towards Danish players to press him?
I don't know where he gets his cardio from. I don't know if he's drinking gallons of EPO before every game, because... You know when the Danish players were dying? They were dying. Every time the ball went out of play, you'd see a Danish player just like cramping up, literally writhing in pain. Sterling is ready to go. I wouldn't have took off Sterling. No way.
So who do you take off then? Because he's already taken off Saka, who's another forward-thinking, front-pressing player. Jack Grealish isn't really one of those players. He's not the sort of player you're going to count on in like a counter-press situation. He's a player that wants the ball, wants to receive the ball, wants to make things happen, wants to create things. He's not really as good as Sterling or Saka or, you know, fresh legs of like Kieran Trippier that can offer something defensively. So that's why it wasn't any sort of like disrespect to Grealish for Southgate taking off. And I think that shows you how far Southgate's come as a manager. Is the fact that he's prepared to take criticism by making those sort of decisions, and he knew that that was gonna upset most of the fans in the country by taking him off.
I suppose it depends how crucial is Kieran Trippier to the winning victory. If you feel like you need to get him on, it's like, who do you sacrifice? And I think Grealish is probably a fair shout. I know with the timing wasn't the best thing, probably not the best thing for Grealish's confidence, really, or going into this, the final. You know, he might have overreaching consequences, but in terms of the game and winning the game, it's not that mad of a decision, really.
I think obviously Southgate loves like for like substitutions. He doesn't really like to tinker with systems. So
I like that though. I like it.
That's why Mount came off. Mount came off for Foden, because obviously Foden can play in a wide area, but obviously he likes Foden in that middle area, and he likes Grealish out wide so that he can almost like come inside if he wants to. So that's why he's been taking Saka off for Grealish, and that's probably why he put Trippier on, I'd assume, in that sort of... I think he must have come on in that wide attacking position, but just to offer extra defensive stability along that side, along either Walker's side or Shaw's side. Might have been Shaw's side.
On the left, yeah.
So he put Trippier on that side just as a bit of extra defensive cover, and obviously he can get forward because he plays in a back five sometimes anyway.
And he's fresh as anything coming on, so...
Yeah. And obviously, as you said, set pieces. Yeah. From set pieces. So for me, there was no real... surprised me with that decision, but a lot of people were.
So it's hard to rate Grealish and the rest of the subs, really. He only got like a little half an hour run out, didn't he?
Yeah, he got so 70th minute.
He did have a couple of little dangerous bits where he's bringing Sterling in, like I remember outside of the foot pass across the box, which could have resulted in something. You know, he was just doing his usual thing and he just didn't have enough time to fully exploit his talents. So I don't even want to rate the subs, to be honest. I don't think it'd be fair.
So I think we'll kind of loosely go through the Italy-Spain game, which is another great semi-final. I think the quality of football in this tournament has been much, much better than what I would imagine. So quickly go over the sort of like Italy-Spain game. We'll talk about it for about 5 minutes and then we'll do the preview of the final.
Oh, sweet. So my main thought while I was watching Italy versus Spain is how do Italy defend the way they do? They were so comfortable soaking up pressure, happy to clear it long and await the next Spanish attack or just wait for their chance on the counter. They were directing each other, encouraging each other, pressing high at times, but there was a pervading sense of calm in their performance. Now, playing on the counter as they did, they had to make their chances count against a very good possession team. And when Federico Chiesa scored in the 60th minute, I thought the game was over. Now, even though Spain threatened and equalised late through Morata, the Italians never lost their composure. And that's ultimately what carried them through the 90 minutes, through extra time, and finally through the penalty shootout. And we spoke about this several times. Chiellini, his mind games against Jordi Alba, as they were deciding what ends to take the penalties on, who's going to go first and all that. I don't think I've ever seen anything like that. He punched Jordi Alba in the face, lightly, pretending he was joking, but he was trying to get inside his
head. It's like guerrilla tactics, man. Yeah, honestly, yeah, yeah. He's a different level of footballer, man. He wants to win so badly. He's a shithouse, man. He's a shithouse. So, like, as we always say, we like shithouse stuff on here, you know what yeah, I mean? Yeah. So, you know, but the Italians, like, as you just said, they never lose composure. The game management's incredible, and it might not be in the sort of like the nicest way possible. We spoke about England and Denmark. Are they a bit too nice? You know, Denmark quite a nice team, not necessarily like gonna resort to these sort of tactics. But Italy might be a little bit different. Like it's gonna be a different.
They want to win.
And yeah. I wouldn't begrudge at any cost.
Yeah. And yeah, I wouldn't begrudge them that, because if England was going on like that, I'd love it. So
yeah, but I mean, Spain dominated possession, and I think Italy did struggle with possession, like with sort of maintaining possession at times. They did look good sometimes. There was a few unbelievable passes from Lorenzo Insigne. Obviously, Chiesa looks very good. Immobile once again was good. So I think the attacking three, although Insigne wasn't really in the game as much as he has been in other
Chiesa games. Chiesa, aside from the goal, he was chasing down everything. You know what I mean? Yeah. Whereas the rest of the Italians, they jog where they look like they should be sprinting because they move as a unit. So everyone's happy moving at half pace because they know they've got everything under control. And this is against Spain, who's like ping the ball here, there, and everywhere. Run, ping, overlaps. It's a very complex attacking system to deal with.
It was really, tactically, it was probably one of the best games you'll ever watch. Like in terms of like the contrasting styles and how they panned out, it was such an intriguing game to watch. Obviously, Spain, like a very good counter-pressing side. So whenever they lose the ball, they want to be within sort of like a close distance so they can win the ball back. And that's a, you know, sort of a philosophy that Guardiola sort of lives by as well. So and sort of Barcelona with their 5 second fury. So we want to try and win the ball back within 5 seconds of losing it. And the spacing of the team is important for that, because if your team's really spread and really spaced out, if you lose the ball, it's going to be a lot more difficult to win that ball back quickly. So Spain did that like absolutely amazingly, and I think that was by far their best game of the tournament. But as you said, Italy stuck in there, man. They held in there. And even though they struggled to sort of break out with possession a little bit more, they did have those moments where, you know, they can get sort of like one or two really clever passes, move the ball forward quite quickly, direct, and be nice and direct, and they put themselves into a good position. So Italy's bread and butter is defending, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah, going back as far as the 70s, man, Brazil, like playing them, they know the Italians are happy to defend. They're proud to win the game 1-0. So we'll do as little as possible going forward and do maximum back here. If that's the philosophy that you're talking about. I've been saying the whole time that if I could choose between Spain and Italy, I'd rather play Italy, because not only do I think it's going to be a better game, I think England would struggle with that possession-based play of Spain. I really do. And I think it runs the arse out of teams. You know what I mean? When you're chasing the ball, you never know when it's coming. Then you got to just be patient. Then you chase. It's mental exhaustion as well as physical exhaustion. And I think against England, Italy aren't going to be as conservative. I think they'll give chances for counters, and I think it's going to be a fascinating, fascinating final.
So that's a good segue onto our preview. So Italy, obviously, as you've heard, away England, and you all know, England away Italy in the final. So obviously, it's our first trip to the final of European competition in our team's history, and we will meet a much more experienced Italian side who are no stranger to finals and final wins. However, they have lost the last two against France in 2000 after their World Cup win in 1998, France is. And then against Spain in 2012 after their remarkable period of success. So they have played very, very good sides, like some of the best European sides of recent memories.
Yeah, they're like generational teams, yeah, aren't they?
So, you know, back-to-back wins at the Euros that Spain had, and then they had a lovely little World Cup win sandwich in between them. So that was probably one of the best teams of all time, that Spain side over that period. So,
definitely.
So, you know, Italy, you know, they'll be looking to add another game to their unbeaten run of 33 games, which is incredible, as they look to close in on an international record held by Brazil and Spain of 35 games unbeaten. So they're only two off that. Italy have averaged 52.3 possession in this tournament. So they're not really a possession-based side. They've had 108 shots at goal, though, and an average of 15.5 a game. So expect Pickford to be busy. Is that a clue to the way football is going now? Because traditionally, we've always thought the more possession you have, the more you're going to dominate a game. But it's not necessarily the case, is it?
Well, it's not the way they're playing. And a counterpoint to that is they haven't played a team as defensively astute as England so far. So what they've done so far in the tournament may not necessarily reflect what's coming in the final. Now, if I had to put money down, I'd say they are going to play their game. But England have been very impressive defending. So
I think that's a great point. I think we are the best defence, and it's weird saying this, but we are the best defensive
it's crazy,
side
isn't it? It is crazy.
That Italy will have faced in this tournament, because obviously Belgium, not great defensively, you know, sort of an ageing back line with Vertonghen and Alderweireld. And Dedric Boateng, I don't really think he's a sort of you know, an international calibre player, a top international calibre player. And then obviously you've got Spain, who notorious, they've been very good defensively.
They defend by retaining the ball, don't they? It's not a solid back four as such, even though they've got Jordi Alba. Back in the day, Piqué, Puyol, those boys, they're quality defenders, but that's not how they win games. They keep it in the middle of the park and run circles around people. So.
Yeah, so I mean, they've had a total of six players get on the score sheet so far, with five players scoring two goals each. Of these, Lorenzo Insigne, Ciro Immobile, and Federico Chiesa. So they make up the front three. So they've got a couple of goals each. All players that have ability to be match winners, and we've seen that in the previous games. Of the Italy team that started against Spain, all but three of the players play in Serie A. So that is a big point. As we said earlier, when we were talking prior to getting on the podcast, we were saying that if they were a FIFA Ultimate team, they'd have 120% chemistry, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
So, I mean, with both Jorginho and Emerson being Chelsea players, although Emerson only playing one game for them this season, so he's had virtually no football. Obviously, Verratti with PSG, they're the only players that aren't in the Serie A. And the other eight players are comprised of two players from Napoli, three players from Juventus, one from Lazio, and one from each of the Milan teams. So you can really see why they've got that sort of togetherness and like a telepathic bond as a team, can't you?
Because everyone talks about the different leagues, because different leagues have different philosophies. You know, in England, it's quite high-paced. In Spain, it's quite tactical, quite a pretty game there. And in Italy, it's all about defending. So, like, you know, it's I know they're split up between different teams, but that philosophy of the league has got to be running through their veins, man. And the fact they all know each other, they're all around each other. Like, they're not, the team isn't spread all over Europe, which could really hurt the chemistry and, like, just their general togetherness in the changing room.
Obviously, that centre-back pairing at Juventus as well, Bonucci, Chiellini. And then you got Donnarumma, who will be the best goalkeeper in the world for quite a substantial amount of time.
It's not bad, is it? That game,
22 years old. Like, he's never conceded two in a game for Italy. He's got like 200 appearances for AC Milan under his belt already. Like, that geezer's going to be as good, if not better, than Buffon.
He looked confident in the shootout as well.
So he's going to be a world-class goalkeeper. But how do Italy set up tactically against England? Obviously, they managed to stifle, for a large part of the game, a much improved Spain side, who without doubt had their best game of the tournament. So defensively, we know how good Italy are. What might their plan be for Harry Kane, Sterling and Saka should Southgate stick with that front three?
You know what, man? I think I don't think they're going to approach the game like that. I think they're going to stick it on England straight away. I think they're just going to poke and prod and see how good England actually are at defending. I think they're going to have a go. Mm. That's not to say they're going to neglect their defensive duties, but no, that's locked in. That's part of that's habit to them. But I think you're not going to see this team that's going to be sitting back and trying to nullify Kane, trying to nullify Sterling. I think they're going to be having a go at us. I think we're going to be doing the nullifying.
But we spoke about England being a little bit of a one-trick pony. Obviously, great from set pieces, but we use that as a kind of like... as almost like a separate part of the game, like in possession, because that's what the Italians do. They actually have in possession, out of possession, transition, which is the moment between two of them, and then set pieces as a fourth phase of play. We are usually the FA only have three phases of play, whereas Italy, they use set pieces as a fourth phase of play. So what does that tell you about how much they value defending set pieces?
That's true, actually. As it's an extra mode of attention that no one else is.
Yeah, mate, it's gonna be a fascinating game. It's gonna be fascinating. I hope I'm not too steaming to watch it. I'm tempted to stay sober just for the game and then have a few beers after it, because I want to be attuned, man. I want to be zoned in for that game, because it's gonna be absolutely fascinating.
There's so many big sporting occasions I've sacrificed for my love of alcohol, and I will be having a few beers, but I think I'll be pretty present for this one. I want to see what's going on.
I mean, and we talk about Kane, how good Kane's been in the last couple of games. We're going to be relying on him to have like the best game of his career, really, against Chiellini.
The whole 11 yeah. has to show up and be the best they've ever been to beat this team. Not only collectively, individually, like that Insigne, he's ridiculous. He can pull things out of the top drawer that a lot of England players can't, maybe only Sterling and Kane. Then you got Chiesa, who can just run and run and run and run. Immobile, not bad. Understatement of the century. They've got some incredible players. And as a team, and for a team to welcome pressure, yeah, bring it on, have a go. We'll boot it. They boot it longer. They seem happy to do it. Do you know what I mean?
Because they know that you're not going to be able to break them down. So areas to exploit for England might be to attempt to drag Bonucci and Chiellini from their defensive positions by having Kane drop into those spaces between defensive lines. That he did so well against Denmark, and that's what created that pass for the second goal, for the first goal, that the pass through to Saka. But these pair are about as tactically astute players as you are ever likely to see, mirroring some of the all-time great Italian defensive partnerships, man.
I don't see Kane pulling them out of position.
Chiellini locked off Lukaku, man, and he's got pace, intelligence,
strength,
can hold the ball. So I know Kane's a different player, and he can sort of, you know, His range of passing is a lot better than Lukaku's, but he hasn't got the pace Lukaku has. But pace won't be an issue, man, because the Italians will not allow you to play, you know, to play long. It will have to be those sort of passes we've been playing in between, on the floor, in between those spaces between centre-back and full-back. I'm telling you, what the Italians will do is they'll all get really compact. They'll let you have space to wide areas. They will let you put crosses into the box all day long, because Bonucci and Chiellini are going to have that for dinner. So they'll let them play wide. They'll suck in. They won't create gaps in between the defensive players. They'll just be nice and compact.
I don't think they will welcome crosses from England.
I honestly think they'll allow crosses. Saka and Sterling, how many... All right, so it's probably Luke Shaw and Kyle Walker. The most of the crosses for England come from the fullbacks, actually, not from the wide players. Because... That's how things have changed, because it used to be the wingers, the traditional wingers, they'd be the guys that would isolate one-on-one, you know, get to the byline, whip a ball in. That don't happen anymore. The wide players of a front three, they're more like for passes in between the gaps on the floor, innit? And then across the through.
Yeah.
So the crosses will come from the fullbacks, Luke Shaw and Kyle Walker. But honestly, the Italians will love that. They will love crosses into the box.
Okay, a couple of points, yeah. What you just said about not getting space in behind, that doesn't just nullify Harry Kane. It nullifies Sterling, Dino and Saka if he starts.
They're the players they're worried about. I don't think they'll be necessarily worried about Harry Kane, because I think they know between Chiellini and Bonucci, I think they can probably, you know, nullify him. But they'll be worried about the pace of Sterling and Saka and those balls, and not preventing those balls getting played in those little gaps.
England are going to have to be a little bit more adventurous, maybe shooting from outside the box and not waiting for that killer pass into the box. Because... just to test the waters and see what's coming. And I think that might serve Because then it's not just going to be Chiellini and Bonucci, is it? They're going to have defensive midfielders in there as well.
Yeah, Jorginho screens that back four really, really well.
So in order to bring them out, you're going to have to do something to bring them out. And you're not going to stretch them when they're all sitting there.
They won't come out.
Yeah? You don't think they will?
Nah, they're not going to high press.
There's going to have to be a screamer then, isn't it?
They're not going to high press. I think they're going to...
No, I mean, out of their own box, I mean. I mean, you're going to have to tempt them to come out and push England out, but you're saying they won't push them out?
I don't think... when England are in possession, I can see them... I can see one player, probably Immobile, sort of cutting off passes between the two centre-backs. So he'll be cutting off the two centre-backs pass. They'll try and force it into one area of the field. I think there's a good chance they might try and force it centrally. Until they get to that final third, then they'll want the ball to go wide, so they'll be really compact. I think when it comes to the final third defensively, I think they'll prefer for the wide players, Sterling and Saka, whoever it might be. They want them getting the ball wide. They don't want them getting in behind and using their pace.
I think he's going to start Grealish, man. Based on what you're saying,
it would probably make more sense to start Grealish because he's going to wind them up, man. He's going to really commit defenders, get fouls. So I think tactically it'd probably be a better thing. And you know, we've seen sort of like Southgate having a word with him more. So like, we've got bigger plans for you. I wonder if that's his big plan. Starting in the final.
If you start Grealish in the final, that again shows Gareth Southgate's thinking ahead. He's not just thinking, okay, we're just gonna bomb into these boys, threaten them with pace. Yeah. He's anticipating a tough game with Grealish on it because. Who would you rather in tight spaces? It's Grealish and Foden, isn't it? You want them in tight spaces because they can play and go and play and go and bring other players in. But I don't know, man.
I don't know where the serves would come from against an Italy team that's in like a low block, really compact, not really giving sort of space in behind. Is Saka going to have that much of an impact?
I don't think Saka's in this game. I don't think so. And that's not cussing him. I think he's been outstanding. He proved me wrong in my pre-tournament assessment of how impactful he was going to be. I don't see him starting this game. Maybe later on.
Maybe Foden, because he quite like Foden in that sort of that 10 position where Mount plays.
If he starts Mount, I'll be flipping, man. Mount, oh God, depressing. But I just need another player to slate off now that I can't cuss Harry Kane. So.
Yeah, we can't cuss him anymore because he's been fantastic the last couple of games. But I think Jorginho, he adds that extra layer of cover by screening that back four. He'll be trying to cut off the passes coming into Kane. So the way Southgate approaches this game from an attacking standpoint, it will have to change. So we are going to see what he's made of Southgate because he will have to make tactical adjustments. And it won't be like the Germany game where it's just, all right, we'll switch to a different system because Hungary did it and we'll just match them up. Because that's a classic managerial move. We'll just match up the opposition. He'll have to do something completely different. He'll have to adjust mid-game tactically. So this is what we spoke about. Southgate not being a tactical manager, we're going to find out in this game, absolutely. You know, Chiellini, as we said earlier, locked off Lukaku, one of the best strikers in European football at the minute. And I think, you know, an area that Southgate may look to exploit will be that Italian defensive side. You know, with that Spinazzola now, he was fantastic all tournament. He's out now, due to his Achilles injury.
Oh, he's not coming back now.
He's out for like 4 to 5 months, so he's done. So Emerson... good replacement, but has barely played any footy this year.
Sound, love it.
I think he's made 2 appearances for Chelsea this season.
But to be fair, in the Spain game, he was putting in some miles, man. He was doing a lot of that defensive closing that they needed to do in the early stages of the game. So
yeah,
I won't be overlooking him based on his lack
and the
of
fact he plays at Chelsea as well. So Mason Mount, Ben Chilwell, Reece James, they'll know how to exploit him. So they'll be having a little word with Southgate.
So many moving parts to this game.
That's why it's fascinating, man. That is why these sort of games are so interesting to watch because, and football traditionally, you know, in the 90s, it was like everyone was playing 4-4-2, you know. But when you come to the international competitions and the European competitions, there's a different philosophy which makes the game a lot more interesting as well. Not everybody plays in the same way. Even though both teams may line up in a 4-3-3, they're not going to play football the same way. There's a different footballing philosophy with each team. So that's what makes these sort of games like the best to watch.
Okay, so we've come to the end of our preview now. I'm going to put you on the spot. I'm not even going to ask you to disassociate your head from your heart. It's impossible. What's the score?
0-0 after 90 minutes.
The tension at Wembley. Oh my God, can you imagine?
And then Italy nick it in extra time.
Ooh, you know what? It's difficult to disagree with that. Difficult to disagree. You reckon it's going to be a bad game or a good 0-0?
No, I think it's going to be a great 0-0. I think it's going to be a real thriller. Like a real tactically tense game. Like a fucking game of chess, man. It's going to be a game of chess.
Yeah, a game of chess.
Which Southgate's going to probably lose because he's no grandmaster.
He's no grandmaster. He's no Bobby Fischer.
I was trying to pull out any chess.
Gasparov and the Blues.
I was like Volkov. I felt like some Russian name would probably be good enough. Like, just throw a Russian name out there, might be alright. What do you think? Score? Well, I'll tell you what the odds they are as well. Because I know there is a few listeners that are inclined in the way of having a tickle.
I can't see Italy not scoring.
You can't see Italy not scoring?
I think they're definitely going to score. I think they've got a load of dangerous players. I think that Insigne is going to score, you know. I think I can see him weaving his way past one or two players and just curling one into the top corner.
Actually, funnily enough, the two scores that are the lowest in the betting are 0-0 and 1-1. 1-1's the most likely result based on what the bookmakers have said, and 0-0 is the second most likely. What does that tell you about how tense and close this game's going to be?
I'm going to put it out there. I think you're right, but I think it's going to be a score draw by 90 minutes. I think it's going to be 1-1.
So you're going with 1-1, I'm going with 0-0.
Yeah.
And then what happens in extra time? Does it go to penalties?
I'm going with my
heart. Can you imagine?
I'm going with my heart. I'm going 3-1 England.
He's flapped it. He's just gone with a generic England score.
No, I'm not.
We still believe.
No. The reason I say this is because I said 3-1 against Denmark. And I wasn't quite sure because I hadn't seen England overcome the kind of adversity that you need to overcome to win a tournament. I don't think, even if Italy score first, I don't think they're going to get rattled. I don't think they're going to get scared. This is all dependent on the individual battles that are going on the pitch, the tactical, all that kind of stuff, taken for granted. But I can see them winning. Sometimes stuff just lines up, and I think it's lining up. That's it. And especially with that Sterling penalty.
We've been blessed. We have been blessed so far. Like, everything has gone our way. Everything has gone Southgate's way, yeah. Literally. And a lot of that's down to his own ability. Like, I'm going to take back, you know, when I said he was a poor manager. Obviously, he's got a lot of abilities as a manager. And I think he's warranted to have another 4 years under this England team. At least the World Cup and then at least another Euros. If they win it, he might be staying there a lot longer. But
he's got an indefinite contract if he wins this tournament. Yeah, make no mistake about that.
Yeah, you can stay for whenever you want. Like,
I think Sterling's going to score as well. Sterling's going to score.
I do think the Italians are going to be too tactically smart for us. You know, they're going to frustrate us. They're going to use every trick in the book to try and, you know, manipulate the players.
But you know what? I think there's a danger in building them up into something bigger than they are. Now, obviously, they're an outstanding team. But I think the way England have approached this tournament game by game, they're not shook, even against Germany. I know Germany ain't the side that they were. But that's a big occasion, man. And you could easily just bottle it in that occasion, in that situation. England didn't do it, man. Even go 1-0 down to that Waldy from Damsgaard, they did not get rattled. I like it. I like it, man. 3-1 England, I'm doing it.
I like it a lot.
I like it a lot.
So, yeah, I think final word then. You going 3-1 England because you bottled it. I'm going to go 0-0. 0-0 draw after 90 minutes.
Battling it will be like 2-0 Italy. That's a predictable one.
But I'm always a pessimist, man. Like, I don't know why. It's with England. I'm just become so unenthusiastic.
I've never cared so much about football. Like, before, I've never watched so much football in the past, like, three.
Yeah, three I almost watch footy as a neutral now. You know what I mean? Generally.
Just ground down by the repetition of it.
Yeah,
all.
Just like so many sort of England disappointments. But, you know, fair play to England, generally. And, like, no credit away from them. Even if they lose this final, man, like, credit to them. Even though they've had, like, another extremely easy route to the final.
Yeah, but they didn't really. Like, the only weak game they had was Ukraine. And that could have been a problem. Denmark are outstanding. Germany threatened, even though we nullified a lot of it. And they weren't the team they were.
Yeah.
It's been like a walk in the park, man. Do you know what I mean? Credit where credit's due.
Yeah, fair enough. Can't disagree with that.
The only group that was proper solid was the group of death. Everyone else had a fair enough chance as England to get through.
And then they all went out in the round of 16.
There you go.
Didn't they? Yeah. So
I think, honestly, I'm
Portugal lost to Belgium, France lost to Swiss, and who was the other one? Germany lost to us. Crazy. I wonder what odds you would have got for that. So you were Germany, France, and Portugal all going out in the round of 16 prior to the tournament. Would have been huge odds.
And then for Switzerland to go out against, was it Spain?
Yeah.
That was mad, that was.
Yeah.
I had them when it went to penalties. I thought this is nailed.
Man, they played really well as well. Look at Denmark and Switzerland, teams of the tournament, really. Yeah, when you think about it, do you know what I mean?
Oh man.
So that we're gonna move on to the combat sports then, because we've had a big old chat about the footy, rightfully so, on the sort of eve of the final.
Oh, you got it, man. It's a once in a lifetime thing. You never know if it's gonna be another 50 years before this happens again.
And obviously there was nothing really in the realm of boxing last weekend or UFC, was there? So this weekend's gonna make up for it.
Well, this weekend there are a few boxing shows, and last week I gave a preview of the Gilberto Ramirez Sullivan Barrera fight on Saturday. And on Friday, Lyndon Arthur headlines a BT Sports card, also featuring Archie Sharp and Dennis McCann, those London boys that Frank Warren's always had a bit of a punch on for. And also, this morning we had the disappointing news that Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder 3 is going to be postponed because somebody in Fury's camp has contracted COVID. That's now looking like it's going to take place in October. That fight just seems cursed to me. The whole situation, him, Joshua Wilder, it's a mess. Joshua's scheduled to fight Alexander Usyk in
next month.
In Tottenham Stadium. So the heavyweight scene, very messy at the bit, and it's making me lean towards my pessimistic tendencies. However, I've got to be honest, boxing is an afterthought for me this weekend. How could it be any other way with the return of the yacht sailing, window smashing, shit talking, woo, limousine riding, jet flying sensation from Dublin, Mystic Mac himself, Conor McGregor. Now, McGregor launched himself to the fore of combat sports when he started lighting boys up in the UFC. This mad Irish guy with Nordic braids, who threw samurai shapes after he won, who wore pinstripe suits and sunglasses and talked with unusual measure and wit, even when he was trashing the life out of everyone around him. That red panty night line he dropped on Donald Cerrone probably hurt more than the head kick he landed a couple of years later when they fought. But let's consider what he's done. Iconic knockouts against Chad Mendes and Jose Aldo, trading bloody wins with Nate Diaz, becoming the first double champ in UFC history, standing across from Floyd Mayweather in the richest boxing match of all time, returning to the cage for his feud with Khabib Nurmagomedov, and now gearing up for a trilogy decider against Dustin the Diamond Poirier. The man has informed, even dictated, the fighting zeitgeist for the better part of a decade. What we've witnessed with his ascension, it must be like when Mike Tyson was terrorising lads by night and doing Pepsi commercials by day back in the 80s. I doubt I'll see anything like it again, but that doesn't mean he's going to beat Dustin Poirier this Saturday. It's UFC 264, it's the main event, 5 rounds or less, the winner gets a shot at the lightweight title. These two fought their rematch this past January. Poirier pulled out of the second round stoppage with calf kicks and punching volume to even the result from their first bout, a 1-round KO by McGregor in 2014. In the rematch, Poirier displayed the poise, the durability that were lacking in the first fight. And for the first time I can recall, I saw McGregor outstruck in the cage. What do you think about this fight?
Well, I was watching the highlights from that bout in January, and I think there's sort of general consensus that McGregor might be, obviously he come out of retirement technically twice, hasn't he?
Yeah.
The general consensus that perhaps his head isn't where it should be. You know, it's kind of, you know he's got his whiskey business that he sold, and he's sort of like, you know, got his finger in various different pies. But I thought he was really good in that first round against Dustin Poirier in January. So, you know, and until that like barrage of shots that Poirier gave him, I think there's a considerable question about whether McGregor has got the sort of the power in his striking to really cause Poirier a problem. Because he seems to take some really heavy shots quite easily.
Clean ones.
And then, you know, Poirier, on the other hand, when he started delivering his strikes, McGregor looked shook. So it's going to be such a fascinating contest. McGregor came out with the idea that he perhaps was taking his eye off Poirier in January because he was more focused on a potential bout with Manny Pacquiao that obviously hasn't materialised yet. If he wants it and someone else wants it and the money makes sense, which it will.
It definitely will, yeah.
It probably will happen. But, you know, what's going to be different this time? How is he going to approach his... How has he approached his training? Do you think that he's taking this fight a little bit more seriously now?
I can't see McGregor failing to adjust his approach from the second fight. The last thing he wants to be is hobbling around again while Poirier is emptying the clip on him. Now, how he chooses to adjust is where the intrigue for this fight lies. Poirier has the better skill set and the better endurance. I've heard a lot of talk over the various promotional videos I've watched calling McGregor far and away the better martial artist. I don't actually agree with that. I feel like Poirier, he can wrestle, he's got submissions, he can box, he can kickbox. Whereas McGregor is really, I don't want to call him a one-trick pony, but he's got a pretty good trick and he knows how to set it up. But in terms of Poirier, he can go to war as he did against Justin Gaethje, Eddie Alvarez and Dan Hooker. Or he can fight more circumspectly as he did in losing to Khabib and in beating McGregor. Now, McGregor has a torpedo of a left hand. Landing a few clean ones has always been enough to bring him victory in the octagon. And so his entire game is constructed around landing that left hand. There are countless technical breakdowns on this fight. I'd recommend Dan Hardy's videos in particular. Going into detail in that area here, I'd basically been parroting like what he's going to say. So if you want something more technical, go to Dan Hardy, go to the UFC breakdowns. They know what they're talking about. I'm basically just listening to them.
You're good at regurgitating it.
If you want the actual breakdown, go to them. But simply put, I'm backing the more complete fighter. The fighter who seems emotionally unaffected by the occasion. And the fighter in better form. Poirier will need to make it through the early McGregor assault because that is coming. No doubt. After that, I think he'll stay cautious for a while and gradually increase his output throughout the later rounds. For all his spectacular knockout wins, McGregor can be gotten out of there. He can be finished. And he doesn't show that same warrior spirit, that same undefeatable mentality that you see from a lot of fighters in the octagon. I think he's a bit of a front runner, to be honest. I think Poirier will do it in 4 rounds, maybe by submission. Before we got into the script today, I watched the pre-fight press conference between McGregor and Poirier. And it really reminded me of the press conference before Khabib and McGregor, where McGregor appeared almost as this caricature of himself, where the witty lines, the humour, the charm, really, of his early career, all those things gave way to this cartoonish version of himself, where he's being overly mean, overly aggressive, overreaching in terms of his persona.
Yeah, because wasn't he saying that, like, he's going to be leaving as, like, a cold body and that sort of shit?
He says, I'm looking to kill this man. And say what you want about that. Reflexively, you pull back from that.
Hold on 1 second. Yeah. Say he does actually go in the octagon and kill him. How does that work in terms of... Because if I say I'm going to kill you and I go and kill
there's
you...
There's a legal issue there.
There's a massive legal issue. So how do they work that around in the UFC?
They sign... This is a mutually agreed upon bout. Sanctioned by Athletic Commission. This is not going to be a problem if something actually happens. You can easily dispel that by saying this is a promotional tactic. And that is what it is.
Yeah.
But for me, that speaks to a level of insecurity on McGregor's part.
So it's not him. It's not almost like he's trying to G himself up. Like,
yeah, because
he's trying to mentally sort of get himself into that zone where... But it's difficult to do that, isn't it?
Well, I watched in the second fight. Like, McGregor was this nice guy. He's like, oh, Poirier, give me a bottle of your hot sauce. And they were hugging at the weigh-in and all this kind of stuff. It was a version of McGregor that no one's ever seen before. Perhaps during the Cerrone build-up. But McGregor versus Cerrone was a squash match. Everyone knew who was going to win that fight. And going in against Poirier, he had the same approach, but against a fighter who was levels and levels and levels above Cerrone. So now he's thinking, I've got that part of the game plan wrong. I'm going to go back to the old, the mean McGregor, the insulting McGregor, the fur coat guy, you know, the trash talker. But, you know, he's not the same. He hasn't got the same wit. He hasn't got the same humour. He doesn't cut to the truth quite as quickly. But what I found interesting about the press conference is, even though he wasn't hitting the same marks as he used to, he still managed to drag a few reactions out of Poirier. You could see Poirier picking up his mic, going to say something, and then putting the mic down, shaking his head in frustration, like, what is this guy on about? It was a really interesting psychological display from both people.
And you don't think he's taking the bait, Poirier? You think he's
I think he was really tempted to take the bait.
Yeah.
If the press conference is any reflection or any prediction of the fight that's to come, and McGregor can tempt him out of his comfort zone, the way he didn't manage to do in the second fight, then McGregor's got every chance in the world to land that left hand.
So I'm going to put you on the spot, and for the listeners that fancy a tickle, give us a UFC double. So obviously you're going Poirier in the main event.
Poirier in four, I think.
What about the co-main event with Gilbert Burns and Stephen Thompson?
Yeah, oh, that's a fantastic fight.
Who's your fancy in that?
Stephen Thompson.
So Stephen Thompson, that'd be a 4-6. So you've gone for the two favourites, but that would give you a £10 double. Would give you something along the lines of about 30 quid, so like a 2-1.
I think that Stephen Wonderboy Thompson fight is going to be spectacular, you know. With the main event, the main event's going to be amazing. McGregor being the fighter that he is, playing on the lines the whole time, looking for the counter left hand. He's never, for all my, I feel like I've been quite critical of McGregor here. If you couldn't tell by my winding intro, I'm a massive fan. I just think that he's at a point of his career where the magic that he was able to effortlessly summon in his 20s is no longer there. And that's all right, man. Time gets to us all. Poirier's been active. He's been through the mire more than once. He's shown technical improvements. More importantly, most importantly, psychologically, he's there. He just wants to win the fight. He's not bothered about getting dragged into this Conor McGregor bullshit. He's there to win the fight, which is why I found it so intriguing at the press conference where I saw little inklings of that. Do you know what I mean?
That's really interesting that you're sort of analysing that sort of psychological battle that these two fighters are going to have, because I think for the average watcher, we probably don't really focus too much on that. So I don't think the average, for example, I wouldn't really think to look into the press conferences. Obviously, if you can catch them on Twitter, little bites of what's going on, you will do. But to sort of look at it analytically and think, right, this isn't the same McGregor that I've seen before. Like, in a way, that says a lot about what his kind of like chances for winning the fight is.
Well, I wouldn't pay so much attention if the psychology of it wasn't such a massive part of McGregor's game. It's impossible to ignore with him. You can't talk that much shit and you can't fight the way you do on the edge all the time, hands low, looking for counters. It's a really risky way to fight. It's a really risky way to conduct yourself, really. You build up everyone's expectations with these bold claims, and then you fulfill your prophecy. That's like some Muhammad Ali type stuff. Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't be paying attention if it was Kamaru Usman or John Jones or anything like that. I really wouldn't. But with McGregor, because of his personality and because of the force that he tries to exert on everyone around him, it's worth taking a look at, man. It's reflected his performances in the past, but the one against Khabib and the one against Poirier now. So I'm really looking forward to it. But I still think Poirier is, the better rounded fighter, and I think he's the more at peace fighter at the minute.
So obviously that card's going to be early, very early morning, isn't it, on Sunday? So it's probably going to be the main card. You said starting at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Obviously, there's a few other fights that are of interest on that card. Obviously, you've got Sean O'Malley. Do you think that's something that listeners, if they're sort of like into the UFC, is that a fight they should check out as well?
Oh, definitely. Sean O'Malley he's in a showcase fight. There was the guy's fighting. I think his name's Chris Martinho. And up until about 2 days ago, the UFC didn't even have a picture of him. So they've dragged him out of somewhere. I don't know where they've dragged him from, but they've dragged him out of somewhere. You're going to see something special from Sean O'Malley. Or he'll get found out as the great white hype that I actually believe he is. But spinning kicks, lead right hands, a lot of dexterity, good movement. He's entertaining.
All right, so that'll round us off. Cheers for listening. We're going to be talking about the final next week, so we're either going to be crying or absolutely jubilant. Either way, we're going to try and talk about it retrospectively, and analytically. Try and give, like as we always do, try and give weight for both arguments about England being the better team or if not better team. Hopefully, our luck continues, and there's a chance against Italy where we make sure that we get over the line, but
I think next week's going to be a fair sequel to this week. It's going to be all the focus is going to be on the final and then the result of Conor McGregor, Poirier.
It's like the European Championships final, part one.
Part two. Yeah. McGregor, Poirier, part one, part two. Yeah. Tune in, man. I can't wait. This is such a sick weekend of sports, man.
And you've also got Argentina versus Brazil in the Copa America final, which is going to be an absolute stormer. I think that's going to be probably a little bit before. So if you wanted to go on the biggest session of your life, start off obviously with this Saturday night with the Poirier McGregor fight, and then stay up all the way through to Sunday evening.
Dear listener, don't do that
for the final, and then early Monday morning. I think it will be the Copa America final. Yeah,
you'll be fighting psychosis of some description if you do that. Stay with us. Stay hydrated. Get 8 hours of sleep. Pay attention. Stay safe.
So are you gonna stay up and watch it, or are you gonna have like a little nap and then get up and watch the Poirier fight?
I'm gonna watch it in the morning. I think, through various means. Say nothing. I don't want to get done for copyright infringement like that. But
yeah, I know. Yeah.
All right, Wicked. Pleasure as always, mate.
Cheers,
see you next week to talk about the big game. Check us out on social media. I will start posting more stuff on there because I've been really weak in the last couple of weeks.
Not as weak as me, mate. I don't do anything on there. So.
And also, we want to get back to doing some of the video stuff as well, which was pretty cool on the Instas. So, yeah, looking forward to getting back on that train. But cheers for listening as always. And check out all our other episodes. And we'll see you next week.